We're learning more today about the March 27 accident involving Tiger Woods. Woods was the only person in his vehicle which crashed and flipped. Jupiter Island, Florida on Friday afternoon. He reportedly climbed out of the car and, according to responding officers, showed signs of impairment. Tiger passed a breathalyzer test but refused a urine test. According to the Martin County Sheriff's Office, Tiger was charged with DUI, property damage, and refusal to submit a lawful test. Take a look at more of the details from the report which was issued today. Woods told deputies he was looking down at his cell phone and changing radio stations. Did not notice the vehicle in front of him had slowed down. He also told deputies several signs of impairment deputies observed. Woods' eyes were bloodshot and glassy and his pupils extremely dilated. Deputies also observed that he was sweating profusely despite Woods sitting in the backseat of a car with cool air flowing. They observed that Woods' movement was lethargic and slow. Woods advised police he took prescription medication early in the morning and two white pills were found inside Woods' pants pocket. Those pills were revealed to be hydrocodone. Now, we reached out to Woods' manager, request for comment. He has not returned that request. But right now, we'd like to welcome in Jody Balsam, professor of clinical law and director of Sports Law Clinic. Jody, what stands out from the incident report?
Yeah, so what we've learned is that Tiger is possibly the only person in the country without an Uber account, and is not a particularly good driver and should know better than to get behind the wheel of a car when he has taken medications, whether they're legal or illegal. And in this case, it sounds like they were legal prescription meds. That does not excuse getting behind the wheel of a car when you're not fully capable of driving. We've also learned that he had in the moment come up with potentially a defense here that it was not his incapacity that caused the accident, but momentary inattention. That wouldn't excuse him entirely, but it might lead to a different set of charges if they could not establish that he was incapacitated. And in terms of the incapacitation, he admitted to taking the prescription drugs earlier that day. So it looks like there's not going to be much of a factual argument as to whether he's incapacitated. And it also looks like the results of the accident were only property damage, not injury to any individual, either himself or the other driver, which also results in a more modest charge, a first degree misdemeanor for DUI with property damage. There was no other human bodily damage. Interestingly, he was also charged with a failure to submit to a urine test under a recently amended Florida state law that requires you, upon being requested by an arresting officer to have your urine tested, requires you to submit to that, which he refused to do, another first degree misdemeanor.
Jody, what do you think that the presence of the prescription drugs that were found in Tiger's pocket mean for this case?
Well, they don't necessarily have any legal significance, and certainly their presence confirms what he's already admitted to, which is that he's regularly taking particularly potent drugs to deal with the pain from his admitted 7 operations on his knee and 20 on his back. That's part of the police report that he discussed with the arresting officers. But the fact that they were in his pocket doesn't necessarily mean anything in terms of proving when and how he took the prescription drugs. And they only confirm the fact that he already admitted to that he is prescribed these very potent pain ameliorations.
Jody, you and I were trading text messages on Friday about this, and I was curious. In 2017, Tiger Woods was arrested on similar DUI charges in South Florida, and he actually went into a program for first-time offenders and got that down to reckless driving. Can he do that again?
Unlikely not. A second offense like this will probably be treated with the full force of the law. He won't get any more harsh treatment, but he certainly won't get any more lenient treatment. The likelihood is he will have a conviction for both misdemeanors, and he will be subject to the full range of punishment that Florida state law provides, which can include fines. For the refusal to take a urine test, it could even include some jail time. I find that to be unlikely, but instead he might be required to undergo some community service. In addition, I think he's looking at a license suspension, probably between 6 months and a year.
Jody, what are the next steps?
Maybe he'll finally get an Uber account.
Jody, what are the next steps legally here for Tiger and his team?
Well, they have an appearance in front of the court in mid-April sometime. And, you know, they will raise whatever mitigating facts that they can offer. For example, his contention that it was not his incapacity, but it was merely a momentary distraction that led to the accident. They will also mention that, you know, the prior DUI was pleaded down and that this current situation should get similar treatment. They might offer to do more community service in exchange for a lighter suspension. There are a lot of arguments they could make, but my bets are that that they throw the book at him this time.
Is there anything about his celebrity status that is going to hurt or help him this time around? And you mentioned his prior, back in 2017, the DUI. Is that going to be considered?
Well, the DUI, the prior DUI will be considered, but I don't think his celebrity status helps him in any way here, especially with a prior DUI. I don't think he's going to be treated more harshly, but I don't think there'll be any appetite for mitigating the outcome here. I mean, it's only by sheer luck that there weren't serious injuries as a result of this crash. He flipped his own car. If there had been a car coming in the opposite direction, his car would have landed on that car, and who knows what might have resulted.
Well, Jody, thank you again for your time. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you.
More golf today after this. We're back on Golf Today. What an amazing moment we witnessed on Sunday as Gary Woodland won for the fifth time on the PGA Tour. This was his first victory since the 2019 U.S. Open. In early March, Woodland went public with a PTSD diagnosis in the wake of brain surgery back in 2023. After his win, Woodland met with the media and discussed the impact his coach, Randy Smith, has had on him both on and off the golf course.
He's more than a golf coach to me. He's always been that way. Obviously, I got out here with him in 2009 as a rookie. I won for the first time with him in 2011. But when I came back from brain surgery and I was in a tough spot, it was my wife's idea. She pulled me aside and said, "I've left you alone for 16 years with your profession. I've never said a word, but you need to call Randy back." And I needed him more for golf, more than golf. And he's stepped up and he's helped me get to this point right here. I've been with a lot of great coaches as well, but what Randy does for me off the golf course is second to none. And for where I've been and what I'm battling, I don't know if I could do it without him.
And Randy Smith joins us now. Thank you so much, Randy, for taking the time. When you hear that sound, when you hear Gary talk about you being, quote, much more than a golf coach, what does that mean to you?
Well, it means a lot. It means that something I said might have resonated with him. You know, you like to hear that because you especially like to hear that when things work out. I mean, he did what he had to do to play the game again at a competitive level that matches, you know, his abilities. And it makes me feel really good that maybe something I did say or something we worked on, you know, helped him out.
Randy, we've documented how difficult the last couple of years have been for Gary Woodland. From your perspective as his swing coach, what are some of the challenges of coaching a player who have been through such a traumatic experience?
Well, the challenges are, number one, understanding exactly what's going on. It's not, in a way, it is, but it isn't unlike working with somebody that's got a back issue or surgery on a shoulder, something like that. You have to know what the background is. You almost have to put yourself in what they feel. And it's kind of difficult to do that in Gary's case, thank goodness. But, you know, if you have an understanding of what they're going through, then you can kind of tailor what needs to be done around that. And Gary, to his credit, was very, very open with me for this whole period of time, what his treatments were, what he's feeling, what his sensations are, how long he can focus, or how long he can hit balls, things like that. And, you know, if you have a good understanding, you can kind of, you know, wrap your hands around it.
When you learn the understanding, when you learn what he was going through, I know his doctors told him that if you wanted to continue down this path, they were going to advise him probably playing professional golf isn't for you, given everything that you have to go through and all of the triggering episodes he was going to have to endure. Did part of you think the same thing, that how can he do this under this microscope?
No, I really never really thought of it that way, because you could kind of see it in Gary's face. He wanted to get back. He wanted to get back doing this. And so his drive and his motivations were overriding the problem. And the only problem is that when you play golf and you get in a tournament situation, you've got galleries and everything, that's not like practicing for 5 hours. That's a whole new amp up on the golf course. You know, we can kind of replicate it a little bit on the practice tee or take him out and hit some shots on the course, but it's not the same as playing tournament golf. But I could see how he would fight through it. The things he fought through, like at Pro Corps, the U.S. Open this year, things like that, most people would not have been able to finish that hole, much less finish that 9 holes or that 18 holes, and then get away from the golf course. And furthermore, not be able, I mean, they wouldn't be able to come back and do it again the next day because it was so embarrassing to them.
Gary told a story last week that when you guys first got back together, you called him quote unquote soft and wanted him to play a little bit more aggressively. What were you seeing at that time, Randy, and what did you mean by that?
Well, you know, that might be a little bit meaner than what I normally am. You know, soft. You tell a 6'1" big guy, you know, you soft, you better be standing away from him a little bit. But what we were talking about, soft, I mean, yeah, soft. He was playing defense. He goes on the golf course, and he would default to a guide shot, in my opinion. Holding the handle, please don't make a mistake. Let's get it up there around the green. Even though he's not talking that way, his shot selections on the golf course were that way. And hitting low cuts into front pins. Oh, gosh. You know, and he didn't mean to, but he knew if I can just hold on, I might not make that big a mistake. And that's what it came across to me. And by soft, yeah, that's playing soft. So when he's here hitting balls, or when I see him and we're working on stuff, I want him to hit all kinds of shots and not default to a guide shot or something that's less than positive. I want him to hit the appropriate shots. If it requires a draw to a left pin into the wind, just hit the draw. If it requires something that's got to get a little more up, hit the ball in the air. Have a good set of targets. Hit the shot that's appropriate for what you're dealing with on the golf course.
Randy, you've worked with some of the absolute best in the game. Scottie Scheffler immediately comes to mind. But when you start comparing some of the greatest performances you've seen on the golf course, where does Sunday rank, knowing everything that Gary had gone through?
Well, I mean, that's in a whole different category. That's kind of one of like those stories that you're going to read about way down the road, because overcoming this, overcoming that, and then playing at that level and winning by 6. I mean, goodness gracious, those are spectacular. So, you know, obviously very high on my list, but it's in a different category. That's overcoming something. That's not overcoming a broken leg. That's not overcoming a broken arm. That's overcoming a brain that has been really messed with in surgery. And it affected so many other things in his, not only his golf game, but his life. And so it's a huge combination of things. This wasn't just a physical, oh, I got back and look at me play with this repaired knee. It's a whole different category.
So how do you explain then, Randy, how Gary Woodland is 41 years old and yet he was leading the PGA Tour in driving distance? He was leading the PGA Tour in ball speed. He said he's playing the best golf of his life right now. How do you explain that?
He's strong like bull. You know, that doesn't hurt that you're, number one, you're an athlete. He's always been an athlete. I'm kind of partial to, I like hanging with athletes. I mean, athletic golfers, I love that because they're easy to work with. As far as the speed came with the ability to start hitting shots. You know, you cannot hit a soft 7-iron up over a tall tree and get a good height on it. It just doesn't work that way. And Gary, being the athlete that he is, he's kept himself in reasonably good shape. I mean, he works out, does his thing. Once he felt comfortable hitting a shot, then it's like any other athlete. You know, watch this. Okay, I can do that even better. Oh, you want me to add 10 yards to it? Watch this. And you do it within a framework of balance. And that driver, especially once he got a driver in the last year, the people have made him a beautiful driver, that he feels comfortable and will not do certain things, he can launch it. And those speeds, I saw one on Sunday up to 196 on ball speed. And that's a ballpark he can play in, you know. And when he's doing that, the ball's going straighter. It's not going crooked. The faster he swings, the straighter the ball's going.
Randy, I would be remiss if we didn't ask a Scottie Scheffler question. Since the Players' Championship, as far as practice go, where has the focus been?
You know, just getting back to, you know, just cleaning up a few things that, you know, a few things that kind of he was having trouble with. And the focus is to clean those up, understand where they came from, and then proceed back to, you know, hitting shots up, down. Which shots do you need to work on? Low left or rights? He is such a great field player, but he sees straight. And that's fun for him to play straight, but I would say 70% of his shots are, you know, moving the ball, the height of the ball, taking some yardage off, and that's basically been the focus, you know. A little bit of this in the golf swing, but mainly getting back to hitting shots and being more reactive to the target.
Randy, players talk all the time about wanting to peak 4 times a year. I'm curious, as an instructor, and we're interrupting you on the lesson tee right now, what's this week like for you as you try to get some of the best players in the world dialed in for a major championship?
Well, you know, I think it's just making them comfortable when they get to the tournament. You know, be comfortable when you go there. I hate working at big tournaments. If I have to do work at one of those, it makes me nervous. I like to sit there and you know, clap and say, that's it. How you feeling? That's good. Way to go. Let's get ready to play golf. Let's still go out here and try to find it on the driving range at Augusta or a U.S. Open, Open Championship or whatever. Be comfortable when you get there. And if anything we can do this week, especially this week, to get him very comfortable before he goes to Augusta, it's going to be a big positive for him.
Well, Randy, can't thank you enough for joining us. And again, congratulations for Sunday. That was incredible.
It was fun to watch. It really was.
More golf today after this.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Back on Golf Today, one of the oldest tournaments on the PGA Tour provides the backdrop as the game's top players get their final tune-up before the Masters, the first major of the year. Coverage of the Valero Texas Open begins Thursday on Golf Channel. Take a look at a couple of players in this week's field who are playing a little bit more than just this week. Some guys trying to get into the Masters next week. You've got Tony Finau, Billy Horschel, Ricky Fowler, Tom Kim, Will Zalatoris, who of course is dealt with injuries. So many different storylines, and I absolutely love this storyline. We welcome back Todd Lewis from TPC San Antonio. Todd, when you're looking at these players trying to get into the Masters, this is a one tournament qualifier, it feels like. Who do you have your eye on?
Well, there are a lot of players that you have your eyes on. You mentioned some of them, Ricky Fowler, Tony Finau, Will Zalatoris. And yes, there is a little bit of extra motivation for those players. We actually started this day with 24 players in the field here at the Valero Texas Open that are in the Masters next week. Now that number has been reduced by one. Only 23 in the field here that will play in the Masters next week, with Colin Morikawa withdrawing from the Valero Texas Open earlier this morning due to residual back issues from the Players. But for the other 132 players that are in the field, that make up this field, I should say, they have a chance. The only way they can get to the Masters and Augusta National next week is if they hold the trophy and slip on those iconic boots, which go to the winner here in San Antonio. And I caught up with a few of those players, and I asked if next week is motivation for this week.
I know, obviously, a win will get me this and all that, but I want to win because I want to win. You know, that's, a win on the PGA Tour means a lot, no matter what you get from it. So, and that's kind of what I've been each week. I've been just trying to play the best golf I can and try to get into whatever tournaments that I can, because obviously I'm not in the signature events or majors or anything like that yet.
I think the start of this year, I've probably put too much pressure on myself because I've been so close to getting in. This week I know what I need to do to get in, but I just like to find some form again. I haven't been playing very well.
You know what you have to do to get in. Yeah. And is that pressure good for you or not?
I mean, it's neither. It's just I know what I need to do, and I feel like it's probably in a way less pressure because you know that it's only you got to win and nothing else matters. Whereas if you know that you have to finish like top 30, it's like you don't need your best golf, but you still need to do it.
I try and prepare the same every week, regardless of the situation. So my job is to come out and do what I do as good as I can and be prepared come Thursday and see what happens. I mean, kind of hear some old sayings and such that are, you know, how you play Thursday through Sunday is determined on the prep you put in earlier in the week. And hopefully I can do some good work and be ready.
Is there some sense of disappointment in the fact that you won in the fall, but you're not in the Masters field?
I mean, it's always been a dream of mine to play in the Masters. I'll have more opportunities to try and earn a place. I certainly understand what Augusta National decided to do, and they gave spots to National Opens and things like that. And it's an international tournament with an international field, so I can certainly take a step back and understand why that decision was made. And I just happened to fall on the wrong side of that coin.
Yeah, it's an interesting story for Stephen Fisk. He won in Mississippi, but he is not in the Masters field. The winners in the fall of 2024 played their way to the Masters with their victories in the fall, but that changed this year from some criteria from Augusta National. So Stephen and other fall winners who are not in the field will have to win here this week to try to get their way to Augusta National. Now, as for those nearly two dozen players who are in the field here at the Valero Texas Open, well, I caught up with some of them who are playing next week, and I asked, what is their motivation here this week? What are they trying to gather before they head to Augusta?
I haven't really, I've done it different ways, I guess, the last few years, but I don't know. I think it just kind of matched up for my schedule. I like this golf course a lot for my game. I wouldn't say it's comparable to Augusta at all, but just individually, I think this course sets up for my game pretty well. I haven't played well here, but I feel it's like I could have a good week here.
So this is a matter of gaining momentum here this week.
No, I'm just here to play the tournament. Yeah, I'm just here to play the tournament. I'm not really trying to prepare for Augusta here this week. I'm just trying to play some good golf.
I think this week is a good way to prepare for next week. See where your game's at, see what you've been working on has been working or not, and you know, if you need to make any changes. So I look at it as a great way to prep for next week.
Is there anything this golf course offers that replicates Augusta National, or are they just two separate entities?
Yeah, I don't think there's too much similar between the two. I don't think so. It's different. It's a lot windier here, although it can get windy at Augusta. But yeah, it's kind of different. But at the end of the day, it's getting the ball in the hole and trying to figure out what you got to do to be ready for next week.
Yeah, JJ's right. Not a lot of similarities between TPC San Antonio, the Oaks course here, and Augusta National. Completely different grasses. The greens here are Poeta, the bent grass greens are at Augusta National. There is a little bit of elevation, and you could make an argument that this is a second shot golf course, just like Augusta National. So maybe a slight bit of similarity there, but not a lot here in San Antonio compared to Augusta National. And by the way, it's pretty common for a player to win here and play their way into the Masters next week. As a matter of fact, the last six winners of the Valero Texas Open, well, three of them have won and gone on to Augusta National. Those players, Corey Connors, JJ Spahn, who you heard from, and Akshay Bhatia. We will see if that happens here this week.
Guys. Of course, it happens last week with Gary Woodland, played his way into the Masters as well. Thank you, Todd. Great stuff. All right, so you look at this week, it's sort of silly to say it's a one-week qualifier for the Masters, but for a lot of players, it is. You start looking at guys who are hot, but you also start looking at players who maybe have a little bit of history at Augusta National, and I immediately go to a guy like Ricky Fowler, who has played Augusta National so many times in his career, but he's gotten to the point right now where he's not qualified. He's trying to scramble. I spoke with his caddy at TPC about... They kind of looked at these 2 weeks, counting last week in Houston and this week, as sort of just a two-week run just to get into the Masters. They knew what they had to do to get inside the top 50 last week. It was probably going to be somewhere around a top three finish in Houston. He wasn't able to do that. He actually missed the cut. So now he's only got one choice this week if he wants to play the Masters.
Yeah, and look, you could probably put Ricky Fowler in the same bucket as boatloads of players on the PGA Tour who have been good but not great this season. You look at a bevy of top 20 finishes, which, look, that's going to be good. That's probably going to keep him inside the top 70, trying to keep the fully exempt status on the PGA Tour for next season. But Ricky aspires for more, a former Players Champion, and he's displayed some good golf. I think when you look at his game specifically, I know he's working on the range right now, but the big strides that he has made in 2026 have been on the greens. I remember back when he was playing his best golf in the mid-2010s, he was arguably the best putter on the PGA Tour. He's not quite that at that level, but he's not sort of at the depths he was a couple years ago. He's well inside the top 20 on the PGA Tour on the greens this season. That's been very beneficial for him.
And you like to see a player like that go back to what he does so well. I think a lot of players on the PGA Tour can get caught up in the idea that I need to improve my iron play. I need to improve my short game. I need to improve my putting. And maybe you ignore the one part of your game that maybe separated you from everyone else. I immediately think of Jordan Spieth in that particular issue. Everything he has gone through with his ball striking, he probably got away from what made him so special back in the 2015 to 2020 range. And that was because you were the best long-range putter on the PGA Tour. So it's good to see Ricky going back to that one thing that sort of made him special. It's always a long shot. But as Todd just pointed out, it always seems to happen. Someone wins at TPC San Antonio and gets a ticket. Why not Ricky?
This is one of your favorite stories, isn't it? When you get to Monday at Augusta National and Masters Week, trying to catch up with the guy who's scrambling to get in there, accommodations, ticket requests, so on and so forth as it relates to the last player in the field in the Masters. This is one of the benefits. You had the cutoff for the official World Golf Ranking last week in Houston. This one is sort of a big old Monday qualifier with everyone who's not in the Masters field trying to get after it. It's good to see Ricky, you know, wants to play in the Masters as well. I know he's tired. He's played in all the signature events this season after finishing inside the top 50 in the FedEx Cup last season. Bunch of guys at this point in the season could use a little break as well. Just shows how much the Masters means to these guys.
And I don't want to dismiss the Texas Open. They do wonderful work with a charity locally in San Antonio. They are one of the longest running events on the PGA Tour. Fisk just pointed out, I'm here to play this tournament. I'm here to win this tournament. Whatever happens from that, absolutely great. But I think in the back of a player's mind like Ricky, you're always thinking about Augusta National, just like you and I always thinking about Augusta National. We'll have more from Augusta after this short break.
Folks, let's flash back to 2000 with Dallas native Justin Leonard dominating the field at La Quintera with a five-shot victory, adding his name alongside Lone Star legends who won the Texas Open like Ben Hogan, Byron Nelson, Lee Trevino, and Ben Crenshaw. And apparently Leonard didn't really feel like surrendering the trophy because a year later, he won it again, becoming the first player since Arnold Palmer to win back-to-back titles with a two-shot victory over Matt Kuchar and J.J. Henry.
And laugh, he was not done. In 2007, Leonard won the Valero Texas Open again. This time, he came from behind for a playoff victory over Jesper Parnevik on the third extra hole after they tied at 19 under par. Time now for a past champ chat. We welcome in Justin Leonard. And Justin, is this one of those situations where it's like your kids, you can't pick a favorite? Or is there one of the three that you feel like you can pick out and go, yeah, that one was the most special?
My favorite one was the last one because my kids got to walk out on the green or, you know, kind of run out on the green. My wife Amanda was there and, that's kind of some of the first memories my kids have of watching me play golf. They remember that day and coming out on the green there after the playoff against Jesper. So definitely the last one was my favorite.
It's not home per se, Justin, but why do you think that you played so well in your home state?
It is very familiar. Going to school in Austin, it's only, an hour or so away from San Antonio. Played a lot of golf down there over the years. And then I think, you know, La Quintera, which is where I won my three, it suited my game. You had to hit the ball straight, pretty small greens. We dealt with some wind at times and some heat and those things. And those are things that have never really bothered me. Plus just getting to play on Bermuda grass, love playing on Bermuda. So just had a lot of things that it checked a lot of my own personal boxes.
Listen, we always hear the cliche in the broadcast that players who grew up in Texas know how to play in the wind. Is there actually validity to that? And do you think that your upbringing actually helped you throughout your career?
I do think there's validity to that. I think there's, thinking back, a lot of the guys that played more on the West Coast and in California hit the ball very high because they play a lot in kind of softer conditions. And so it served them well as juniors. In Texas, the wind blows a lot. I mean, I can remember playing junior golf tournaments in the summertime and going out to Wichita Falls and place like Abilene, Texas, where, normal events, you'd be like, oh, well, it's too windy to play. Well, we were playing anyways. And so you had to figure out a way to get it around. And so I do think there's validity to it going up in wind. I think it's a reason why I've always loved playing, going over and playing in the Open Championship so much, because the conditions a lot of times warrant you to keep the ball on the ground. And that's, kind of the way I grew up. I grew up on a tree line, very narrow golf course at Royal Oaks, but as a course where you could bounce the ball up into the greens. And so, being a young junior, not being able to reach all the par fours and stuff like that, I kind of got used to it. And I've never much mind playing in the wind. I think it just engages a kind of another level of creativity and some shot making that I've always really enjoyed.
Justin, we've spent a lot of time on this show talking about the future PGA Tour schedule, what it might look like, and as it applies to this event. Why is this event important on the tour schedule? And the second part, is the spring the right time to play this event? You played it both in the fall and the spring.
Yeah, it's, the fall, it's, I'd say the weather is more predictable, but you're running up against, football. And football is big in Texas, as you know. So it's not always an easy sell for sponsors and for, fans that want to come out. But, it's one of the longest running tournaments on the PGA Tour. I don't know how many years, but it's a whole lot. And it's close to my heart. I mean, there's so much great golf and the history of golf in the state of Texas. A lot of great golf courses, those things. I mean, I'd love to see that the Texas Open be able to continue, in some form or fashion. I mean, maybe if there aren't great plans for it on the PGA Tour, maybe they'd bring the over 50 circuit in there and continue the tradition of the Texas Open.
I love the optimism on that, Justin. It's a little bit bigger picture as it applies to this conversation. When you hear about the possible changes to the tour schedule, when Brian Rollout, the CEO of the PGA Tour, talks about scarcity, do you have any concerns about what the tour may become based on what you played coming up?
I don't have any concerns, but I know it's going to look a lot different from the sounds of it, the things that I'm hearing and reading. I understand you're trying to maximize your sponsors, maximize value for your fans and also your players. And I think, the players that have come first for a very long time, and not that they're going leaving from having that first position, but finding more value for sponsors and fans, I think is a big key to all this. And part of that is creating the best fields you can and having the best players play together more often. You look at, I follow F1 a little bit, and, you've got, obviously you only have 20 seats, but you've got the best drivers racing against each other all the time. And I think it's a model that the PGA Tour would love to have. I don't have a problem with having a week off here and there. I think that'd be great for the players. It helps re-energize. I mean, obviously guys take weeks off, but actually having a forced week off, every few weeks, I think is good. I mean, it's what I love about the Champions Tour schedule is that we kind of ease into the year. And then, if you want to play three events in a row during our main months, which is April through October, you can do that. I choose not to do that very often. I normally take a week off in between or take a couple weeks off here and there. And so, I think staying fresh, you know, these guys put a lot of stress on their bodies through practicing, playing, traveling, and all those things. And I think having those forced weeks off could really actually serve the players very well.
Justin, this time of year, this week in particular, Valero Texas Open, we're always looking ahead to next week at the Masters. When you think about your career record at Augusta National, just two top tens and 15 career tries, how do you reflect on that? And what did you maybe learn about your experiences there?
I loved my time at Augusta National playing the Masters. You know, once they really lengthened the golf course, I think it was in 2000, I saw my window get very, very small. I think my two top tens were before 2000. When the golf course got as long as it did, I found myself hitting a lot of 4 and 5 irons off of downhill lies, which, you know, going back to our conversation a little earlier, I'm kind of a low ball hitter and not a very high spin guy. And so I struggled a bit there, and I loved my time there. You know, it's a time when I get to see our family and our, you know, our kids. And I don't know. I mean, I think Wednesday might've been my favorite day at the Masters because of, you know, the par three experience. And I had, you know, friends caddy for me, my kids, as they got old enough. They really weren't old enough, but they did it anyways. And so Wednesday was just such a fun day. And it's just, it's such a unique experience. And I've actually enjoyed, I'm not going this year, but I've enjoyed going back the last few years, doing, you know, more on the corporate side, but getting around and walking around a little bit without the pressure of, you know, trying to make 6 footers on those greens. It's a great experience. And I tell you what, if you ever get a chance to go, you have to, because the whole experience outside the ropes is just phenomenal.
Justin Leonard, the patron. I love that idea. Real quickly, I noticed it looks like there's a very expensive bottle of wine behind you with the Ryder Cup logo on it. We all know the ongoing conversations. There is a short list of possible captains. What would be your argument to be on that list and to be the next captain?
Oh, my argument to be on it. I think having a little bit of separation from today's players, even though I know all the guys from doing television or you know, here in South Florida, I think having a little separation would be a good thing. You know, bringing guys in that obviously the players know very well as far as assistants, things like that, I think would be important. But having a little separation at the captain, I think that's actually an advantage to the job. And then I think, you know, thinking more long-term, I mean, the Europeans have done such a great job with, you know, bridging from Ryder Cup to Ryder Cup. And now you've got the same captain for 6 years in Luke Donald. Not that I think a captain needs to go that long, but why would you change it if you're on the European side? But I think having a little more of a long-term strategy from a captain's and assistant standpoint and having maybe more continuity. Again, I haven't been in the room, so I don't know really what it's been like the last few years, but I think continuity and having a little more of a long range approach when it comes to captains, assistant captains, and the back of the room staff, I think, you know, if those things aren't happening presently, I think they certainly need to. And I think we should borrow as many ideas from, you know, the European side because of the success they've had, and yet, you know, put our own little American twist on it, as you know we will.
Justin, as always, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Just as a reminder, this is how you can watch coverage of the Royal Texas Open Thursday, Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern time on Golf Channel. Coverage begins on the weekend at 1 p.m. Folks, how about this? Little news today before we get out of here. Michelle Wee West announcing she is coming out of retirement, not to play in the WTGL, but the U.S. Women's Open at Riviera. Wee West, of course, won that championship back in 2014. Pretty unbelievable. If you're going to come back, certainly want to come back at Riviera. That was an interesting conversation with Justin Leonard, because you look at Tiger Woods, and he's the big story of the day with some of the details coming out in that probable cause affidavit. Where would you put Justin Leonard on the reasonable short list of U.S. Ryder Cup captains?
Before I just ask that question, maybe outside the top five. After I asked the question, it's clear he had thought that through. I don't know if he's made the pitch to the PGA of America. I'm not quite sure if he's on that short list, but certainly he's thought it out.
And look, there was a soft deadline for Tiger Woods at the end of this month. We're at the end of this month. They're probably going to have to come up with a plan B. Could do a whole lot worse than Justin Leonard.
Absolutely. That'll do it for us. We'll be back tomorrow for lead-in coverage to the Augusta National Women's Championship. See you then.